Hello, and welcome to episode 109 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We are here today with Donald Cohen, Executive Director of In the Public Interest. Donald, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Thank you.
Excellent. The first question I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing, or what have you ever done to advance the public interest, and why?
Well, that's a big question. I've been doing this sort of work for many, many years, more than 30 years. So let me start with what some of the things I'm currently doing. I and the organization that I run, we are focused right now on developing a policy agenda and a political agenda and a governing agenda so that, you know, governments happen, so that public services are delivered in the people's interest. That's kind of broad. Let me give you some examples. So in public education, we're very concerned about in the current trend and the rapid growth of charter schools. We are not opposed to charter schools. They can be good things, but they have been growing so quickly that they have gone beyond what they were supposed to be as in, you know, laboratories of innovation, to be heading towards what looks to be like a competing education system. We think there's real problems with that. We're also focused on looking at public infrastructure, the needs of, you know, for rebuilding America, and wanting to make sure that that's done with high standards and lots of transparency and real accountability and complete public control over the things that we all depend on. So let's just give you a couple of examples.
So you spoke about education, public infrastructure. Also, you've been involved in criminal justice. There's been lots of issues you've been involved in. What is it that originally began to get you involved? How did you originally come to create In the Public Interest as an organization and then choose to focus the organization on these particular issues?
Well, I guess probably the most foundational thing is, you know, we believe that public institutions are essential, that they need to be strong, they need to be capable, they need to have the authority to deliver on, to deliver public goods, the things that we all rely on, the things that we all count on, and the things that we'd like to deliver to every American, like, you know, good health and a clean environment. So when you start with that, then the next thing you look at is, well, are the decisions being made in, you know, in a way, in an uninhibited way to advance those interests? And what we see over and over again, that in fact, contracts are created, power is developed by private interests, long-term, prisons are privatized, and, you know, and lots of things like that, where the where private interests can often actually squeeze out and overtake public interest.
Was there a particular seminal moment of incident where profits were put before the public interest by publicly elected officials or other public decision makers that inspired you to move down this path of leading your own organization?
No, I don't think there was a seminal moment. I've done a lot of reading about history and what's happened over the 20th century and when government was important and was able to do things. And I think if there was a seminal moment, it was 1994 when the country took a pretty dramatic turn to the right in those elections.
Our listeners who don't know, Mr. Cohen is referring to Newt Gingrich's contract with America that swept in a Republican majority into the U.S. Congress.
That's right. And so we, you know, what I started to look at, what had happened between 1964, say, early 1960s, when, you know, popular opinion polls showed a real trust in government and a belief that government institutions, if well run, were a valuable part of, you know, what makes America strong. And 94, when there was a pretty, you know, and then to 94, when there was a pretty strong rejection of government. There's obviously lots of factors to that, but one of the things that is very clear is it wasn't an accident, that there were, in fact, institutions, political organizations, think tanks created to, in fact, accomplish that. And those were all
right.
funded, and they're funded by corporations because that's where the money is.
So it seems that what really motivates you is a desire for government to put the public interest first, and according to you, doing that would be to not rely on privatization of government, but actually to keep government public. Is that a fair assessment of what your perspective is?
Yes, sort of. It's more because government's complex. So we say to keep control. You know, first, better way to say it is to keep control of those services. Governments have been contracting for things for, you know, forever. And, you know, right now we think there's almost $2 trillion in contracts, procurement that's done by federal and state unions. And some of that's buying airplanes and some of that's or cars and some of that's, you know, privatizing services. But the point is when something is contracted,
mm-hmm.
then it has to be regulated, you know, it has to be transparent, it has to be overseen adequately, it has to be have high standards. And so we don't want to privatize public function.
Mm-hmm.
Even if someone else is doing the work, that stays in control, which implies a lot of things have to happen. You have to you have to hire the right staff. You have to oversee the contracts. You have to do a whole lot of things. There are some fundamental things that we think there is no role for private companies, and that's particularly prisons.
So let's delve into prisons for a moment then. We'd mentioned so you said prisons offer a public service, which is to keep individuals deemed unfit for society, at least for a certain period of time, out of society. Why is it that that prisons ought not to be privatized?
Well, first off, you don't want, you know, we have real, you know, clear idea of what should happen around criminal justice. We want, regardless of how you feel about crime policy,
mm-hmm.
you know, ultimately we would all like less people incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they have a job, whether they're not committing a crime, whether they have mental health issue and are dealt with them through a mental health system. You know, that's a goal. And when you privatize prisons, you insert other things happen. You insert their interests. And I'll give you some of the very concrete examples. It's very simple. So first of all, private company's goal or, you know, purpose is to generate revenues and generate profits, generate returns to their investors. That's a legitimate and reasonable thing for them to do, but that's really all they do. So they can do that in two ways. They can guarantee revenue, so that more money comes in and raise, and then they can also cut costs. Those are the only two things that can happen. So on the generating revenue side, we analyzed private prison contracts around the country between state governments and prison companies, and found that about two-thirds of them had in the contract what we call bed guarantees of 80, 90, and 100%. In other words, keep the beds full or pay anyway. So that's an incentive to keep the beds full.
You're referring to keeping the beds of prisons full with prisoners. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So their interests are different. They make money, and you can look at their corporate statements. They make money by having more heads in beds, say, having more prisoners incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
Their interests are different. And, in fact, they talk about that in their corporate filings with the SEC, that one of the things that could be a risk to them is criminal justice reform. And it's logical. Less people in prison, they have less chance to make money. But then the other things they do, and the other side of the equation, of the mathematical equation, is cutting costs. And so they say we can do it more efficiently. We always ask one question. Efficiency means you're going to spend less money on something and get more. What are you going to spend less money on? So they spend less money on wages and working and benefits for staff. What you get from that is higher turnover, lower quality staff, less trained people, more dangerous prisons. They cut corners on quality of the food. Michigan and Ohio prisons had a problem, it was last year, the year before, with maggots in the food that caused, you know, not quite riots, but disturbances in the prison because inmates were, you know, they want to eat good food. So when you spend less money, they spend less money on programming, you know, to help people get job training and stuff like that. So there's really not that many choices. Yeah, that's the only thing they do. And remember, the last thing to remember here is that they're taking money out of the provision of the service in profits. Those profits are money that actually should be spent on the service.
If we were members of the Michigan State Legislature, to use your recent example, and we've been spending Michigan state tax dollars on financing Michigan's criminal justice system, and we have prisoners going into the prison and are getting food and are doing programs, and you're having correctional officers who are taking care of them and who are getting health benefits for their families. What goes through such a Michigan legislator's mind to say, you know what, I think we really ought to be privatizing this prison, and I know that the way that we're going to privatize it because we want to save money. And the way we're going to save money is by cutting benefits and cutting corners. Why does that legislator not just avoid the middleman and say, hey, we're going to cut benefits and we're going to cut corners and we'll keep it public and just make it more efficient ourselves? What's the need for the private company?
Well, the basic reason is because they don't say all of what you just said. They stop at one point. They say, private business can do it cheaper and better and more efficiently. They don't say, and by cutting wages and providing lower quality food. They don't say that part. They operate within a larger kind of theme of business is good and business and government is bad. What they don't, if they ask that follow-up question, what are you going to pay the workers? What impact does that have on the quality of what goes on in the prison, of the quality of the workforce, the training? Even asking the question, what impact does the food have on the safety of the prison? It's one of the two most important things to inmates are the food and access to the telephone. If those things aren't easily good and accessible, they're angry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you could say, well, that's too bad. But the bottom line is there's people who are incarcerated and there's other people, you know, and then there's workers who are supposed to keep control of those workers. And what you want is a safe, productive environment that where you can then focus on helping people not come back to prison.
Would you say that it's kind of a game of political kicking the can down the road where the politicians in this case may actually be aware of how business could be more efficient but are unwilling to take the hit themselves, and they're not willing to look voters in the eye and say, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to actually treat prisoners worse and thereby save tax dollars. Instead, we're going to allow the blame to be pushed onto some private entity. Do you think that's potentially the rationale for privatization of the criminal justice system?
Yes, I do.
So why is it that voters are being duped by this? And if they're not being duped by that, why is it that voters aren't demanding better? And then finally, what role does In the Public Interest, your organization, have in educating voters and in educating legislators and trying to bring truth and transparency to this process of privatization of the criminal justice system?
Well, first off, the decisions about prisons, whether they're private or not, and who provides the food and all that, are not made by voters. So that's just, you know, obviously. But to be clear, they're made by legislators. So that's number one. And it's hard for voters, you know, for ordinary folks to pay attention to all the different issues and bills that are going on. That's a real thing. The second thing is you have to remember is most prisoners, many prisoners around the country are disenfranchised. They're not allowed to vote, number one. So their interests are not represented at all. And in the broader, you know, most people are not in prison. And so they're not a sympathetic audience. They're not a sympathetic constituency, right? They're prisoners. Many people believe they deserve to be there. So this is taking the weak and ignoring them because they are weak politically.
So what is the role of your organization?
So we don't so much educate voters as we educate people who are advocating. We educate policymakers. We give them the facts. We give advocates and those that are fighting for these things, and you know, again, in cities and states across the country, the tools to ask these hard questions. Okay, so All right, you're going to privatize it. What are you going to spend less money on? How much are the workers going to make? How much, you know, make the decision makers ask and answer the hard questions, not just that it's cheaper. Go past that. You know, it may be a little silly to even say this now, but we're in kind of a post-fact world right now. There are people who get elected to privatize things. That's their ideological predilection. That's the team that they're on. That's what they want to do. They want to make government smaller. They want to, you know, they want to spend less money. They want, you know, that this is not about, these are not people who get elected and want to say, how do we reduce the prison populations to make America better? That's not a lot of their goal.
So if they want to privatize things and voters and legislators don't have too much compassion for disenfranchised, incarcerated individuals, then why not just come out and say, look, these guys committed crimes. They've given up their right to participate in society, and they don't deserve the right to nice food that doesn't have maggots in it at taxpayer expense. If they want food without maggots in it, then they ought to not to commit a crime, to get a job, earn some wages, and use those wages to buy food without maggots in it. If that's really the philosophy that these individuals have, and they just want to privatize and they want to save money and no one cares, no one has compassion for the incarcerated population, why don't people come out and say it?
Well, some do say that, what you just said, you know, they deserve to be there, some do. And, you know, there are people in prison who ought to be in prison, people who murdered somebody and what have you. There are people within there who aren't sympathetic, they're sociopaths or what have you. But even if that's true, right? Mm-hmm. Even if people deserve to be in prison for some point, I'm not going to weigh in on that right now. There are far too many people in prison, no question. They all don't deserve to be there based on the existing laws. But it doesn't actually help in the long run to treat inmates that way. You guarantee you guarantee recidivism.
Could you explain for our listeners what recidivism means?
Well, that people, you know, they get released when they do their time, and then they create, you know, they commit another crime, and they go back in.
And is it more expensive or less expensive for someone to be in prison as opposed to not in prison?
Well, if you're not in prison, you're not paying anything for them. But of course, it's cheaper that way. I mean, you know, prevention is always cheaper than the cure.
Isn't there a national movement towards criminal justice reform that, in fact, has bipartisan support because it is more fiscally responsible to keep inmates from recidivating or, as Mr. Cohen just explained for our listeners, returning to prison at taxpayer expense and to reduce the amount of riots in prisons and to just make everything safer? Wouldn't it be cheaper to have criminal justice reform than to privatize prisons?
Well, yes. I mean, so the answer is there is bipartisan interest. We're not clear how far that interest will go. The bipartisan interest is not necessarily opposed to privatizing the prisons. There are the conservative wing of the bipartisan like privatization. There, in fact, prison populations did go down this last year. There is efforts to reduce, you know, there's numbers that are going down in juvenile in detention. And so, you know, that's happening from a number of factors. You know, you can't just put it on one. The real question is you know, will, in terms of the two real fundamental things, two or three that really need to happen, and the question is, will these bipartisan coalitions have the strength to do that and the interest in doing that? That's a big question. So the first thing you got to do is really reduce, you know, prevent people from going in the first place, right? And that's a combination of, you get rid of some of these mandatory sentences, mandatory minimum sentences for low-level, nonviolent crimes. There's too many people being locked up. You should, you know, eliminate the bail system so that people who just can't afford the bail don't have to spend nights in jail. They're not going to flee. You should create better jobs. We should be creating better jobs that pay decent wages so people don't commit crimes for those types of folks. So that's the first thing. The other thing is you know, we're putting a lot of people in the wrong place. Our fundamental mental health system in America is our jails and prisons. The numbers are huge. So we need to actually build a mental health system that actually helps people deal with, you know, with real serious issues. you know, huge numbers of people, huge. I think if we had a mental health system that was decent, a third of the population would be gone tomorrow. So
and
those are the things they need to do.
Interesting. So there's a lot of confluence between the criminal justice system and the healthcare delivery system. I just would like to pivot a little bit in our conversation to bring the focus right back to you, Donald. I'd like to ask, could you take a moment, how you actually got here? You spoke about the civil rights movement in 1964 with the open acceptance of government. You spoke about 1994, kind of rejection of government. But what is it that brought you in particular here? What were you doing before you came to become the executive director? How have you kept this going? Why is it that this matters to you so much? Why be the executive director in the public interest? How did you come to be the director?
Well, I've been involved in these sorts of things for many, many years. I said earlier, 30, 35 years. And I just believe that, that one of my responsibilities as a citizen is to try to, leave the place a little bit better than it was. What motivates me is I really hate greed. I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And on the positive, I think, many of the things that we want to do are actually really possible. We could have a clean environment. We could have decent jobs. We could have good schools. We're not trying to figure out how to break the barrier of light speed, to get to another galaxy. We actually know how to do everything we want to do to make this place a better place. So the only reason we're not is greed and power.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like political will and seems to be one of the focuses of your efforts. You attempt to change political will in this nation to achieve what is already known and in practice in certain areas, but not widely in practice. Is that a fair?
Yeah.
Okay.
Everything that we all care about is fundamentally a political decision. We live in a society. We decide together what we want to do together and what rules we want to set, what rights we want to establish. Every decision is political.
So as we approach the end of this podcast, I'd like to ask you just one final question. We've covered a good deal of ground talking about criminal justice, you alluded briefly to charter schools evolving from being centers of innovation to really competing with the educational system in America. You spoke about a desire to invest more in public infrastructure. Could you take a moment to speak to our listeners about how you identify these priorities? What do you hope your legacy will be? Why did these policy priorities in particular matter so much? Why is the art of the possible so worthwhile advancing? So take a moment and just speak a little bit about what it is that you really hope to accomplish in the long term through your role with your organization.
Well, I think in the long term, we want to reestablish that public institutions are the only types of institutions in many ways that can accomplish the things that we all need to accomplish together. There is a role for markets. There is a role for private companies. There are roles, there are responsibilities for both of them as well as individuals. But if the things that we need to do together, which are a lot, both because it's the right thing to do and it's because it is in our interest to do it, can only be done with public institutions. So, let's take education. Whether you have a child or not in schools, it is in every one of our interests, every American's interest, to have good schools, high quality schools that everyone has access to, so that we have an educated nation. That's not just about your kid getting educated. It's about making a better nation. Public criminal justice is fundamental. We will have it's in our interest to have fewer people in prison, even if no one in your family has ever been in prison. Same thing with infrastructure. We want good roads. We all drive to get to work, to school, to church, to the beach, what have you. So that, so that makes a better life for all of us, and it also happens to create a better economy and a stronger economic growth. So our long-term goal is to reestablish that, in fact, public institutions and public solutions are the only one that can deal with us all, and the only ones that can deal with everything we need to deal with, not just, one thing at a time.
and that has been Donald Cohen, Executive Director of In the Public Interest, who speaks about his career in public service as being one that identifies the art of the possible, and he feels very strongly about advancing and protecting public institutions as institutions that can fulfill the public interest. He sees many positive externalities associated with various services that government provides. Whether or not you are a child or have children in the educational system, public education is a means of long-term economic development, of having an international competitive edge. He speaks about criminal justice not only as a matter of compassion for the prisoners who are incarcerated, but as a means of giving taxpayers a better return on their dollar. He talks about fairness and about wanting to make America more fair at the expense of greed. He works to curb the influence of greed and avaricious pursuits of power in order to create a more just and equitable America. And for Donald, that is what makes it worth it, pursuing a vision that will create a more lasting and just society. So, Donald, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
And this has been episode 109 of a Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Please join us on publicinterestpodcast.com or on iTunes or any Apple product podcast app. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.